X-ray machine, and dismissed our thoughts as so much bravado. It is true that we had an agreement to go to the aid of Long Vey in the event it was threatened with being overrun, conceded Major Jim Stanton, Quezon's Marine Artillery Coordinator, but the situation at the combat base deteriorated so quickly and so completely that it should have been obvious to anyone that we could no longer guarantee their security. Aides woke General Westmoreland twice that night with news of the Long Vey attack. Colonel Francis Kelly, the 5th Special Forces Group commander, urged him to dispatch a relief force, but Westmoreland hesitated to override the Marine command. Privately, Westmoreland saw the refusal to send in a rescue force as the final act in a dispute between his headquarters and the Marine Corps. He ordered a conference with Marine commanders in Da Nang that very morning. By sunrise at Long Vey, the NVA were trying to blow the door of the American-held bunker with satchel charges. When that failed, they tossed grenades and tear gas down a vent. Choking men pressed their faces to cracks and gasped for air. An NVA officer promised, "Give up and we will not harm you." The Arvin commander and several Vietnamese officers scrambled out, only to be summarily executed. Then explosive charges rocked the bunker and knocked all 8 Americans unconscious. Arriving in Da Nang, General Westmoreland immediately ordered Marine Lieutenant General Robert Cushman to provide helicopters to lift the SOG rescue force from Quezon into Long Vey. Reviewing what had been transpiring in First Corps, Westmoreland grew more and more shocked at things that virtually begged to be done yet remained undone. He issued orders to Cushman's subordinates, violating the Marine chain of command and ruffling such feathers that he heard about it from the Joint Chiefs. Westmoreland wrote, "That was the issue, the one issue that arose during my service in Vietnam to prompt me to consider resigning." At Quezon, Major George Cuomo and Master Sergeant Charles Skip Minix could see smoke rising in the distance as they called together the recon teams. Cuomo recited the dangers of going into Long Vey, then asked, "Okay, who wants to go?" A dozen Americans grabbed their Car 15s, assembled 30 Nungs and Yards, then climbed aboard the Marine choppers. The Marine Command's attitude affected the pilots, who showed no enthusiasm to rescue a bunch of gooks at Long Vey. Shocked to see the destroyed tanks and collapsed buildings, they kept circling and circling in their big CH-46s. Finally, Major Cuomo demanded that his command chopper go in, and at last they all landed. Fanning out, the SOG men trotted bunker to bunker searching for survivors. Thousands of NVA were nearby but stayed hidden, fearing U.S. airstrikes. Most surviving Americans owed their lives to Sergeant First Class Eugene Ashley, who died that morning leading repeated assaults to push the NVA from Long Vey. He was awarded the Medal of Honor. Several wounded Americans survived because Lieutenant Key, an Arvin, raced his jeep through the enemy to retrieve them. The SOG men assembled the U.S. survivors and as many Montagnard wounded as they could carry and called in the Marine helicopters. As the rescue force lifted away, RT Alabama 10 John Allen saw an American dash into the airstrip waving his arms, but there was no going back. He was left to his fate. The abandoned Green Beret, Dennis Thompson, survived 5 years as a POW. Of the 24 Special Forces defenders at Long Vey, Major Cuomo's SOG men brought out 14, all but one wounded. Long Vey had shown the enemy what losses awaited them at Quezon. Of the 11 attacking tanks, 7 were destroyed, with 2 more probables, plus 250 North Vietnamese dead. A full-scale ground assault on Quezon would have been disastrous. SOG's greatest contribution to the siege of Quezon was also its greatest Laotian achievement of 1968, uncovering a major enemy stronghold and munitions stockpile near Khao Rock. As a result, the SOG report notes, an arc-light B-52 strike was conducted, resulting in continuous secondary explosions over a 2-hour period. General Westmoreland, in his memoirs, described how the big bombers hit a military headquarters in a limestone cave inside Laos, believed to be the North Vietnamese headquarters controlling the forces around Quezon. if not the entire northern region of South Vietnam. He noted, radio traffic from the headquarters ceased for almost 2 weeks. There was evidence of considerable confusion in the North Vietnamese command in the north, and no major attack developed at Khe San during Tet. In late March, while the 1st Air Cav began its push to break the Khe San siege, R.T. Asp inserted 25 miles to the northwest to track the withdrawing NVA. Led by Sergeant First Class George Brown with Sergeants Charles Huston and Alan Boyer, R.T. Asp was suddenly hit by a massive NVA force. A King B going in for Brown and Huston was driven off by intense ground fire. Another King B spotted Alan Boyer and dropped him a rope ladder, which he snatched amid a hail of fire. But the ladder mount broke, apparently hit by a bullet, and Boyer slid back into a sea of NVA. None of them was heard from again. 205 Marines and soldiers died during the 77-day Khe San siege. NVA dead were estimated at 10,000 to 15,000. As things wound down, Major George Cuomo, who led the Long Bay rescue, left Khe San aboard a SOG plane, which disappeared in bad weather while bound for Da Nang. Major Cuomo's remains were recovered in 1974. A few weeks later, SOG's Khe San FOB closed. Its personnel reassigned in SOG, and its launch site role shifted east-northeast to My Lok. On the last day of March, President Johnson suspended bombing above North Vietnam's 20th parallel. This meant only North Vietnam's southernmost 150 miles remained subject to air attacks, and all air attacks would end on the eve of the November elections. Previously, there had been a cost in manpower, vehicles, and cargo for each mile they flowed south, but now a sizable length of that route became immune from attack. North Vietnam soon began running 100-truck convoys in broad daylight across rebuilt bridges and repaved roads, freeing thousands of engineers and anti-aircraft units for transfer to Laos, where they expanded the Ho Chi Minh Trail. As fighting declined around Khe San, other SOG teams were penetrating Cambodia to learn whether the enemy was back in his sanctuaries after the Tet Offensive. On 2 May 1968, a SOG recon team led by Sergeant First Class Leroy Wright inserted into Cambodia's Fishhook, 75 miles northwest of Saigon, for an area recon mission. Going in with Wright were Staff Sergeant Lloyd Frenchy Musso, 1-1, and Specialist 4 Brian O'Connor, 1-2, along with 9 Nongs. Watching them launch that morning from Quan Loi was an old friend of Wright's, Sergeant First Class Roy Benavides, a heavyset Yaqui Indian, a likable teddy bear type, who did support jobs at the launch site. As the Hueys faded in the west, Benavides shook his head respectfully, awed by the kind of bravery it took to operate behind NVA lines. Soon after landing, Wright's team hit an enemy squad and shot its way clear. A half hour later, the team fought through a full platoon and got back to the insert LZ, but so many NVA fell upon them that heavy fire pinned them and forced away rescue Hueys. One gunship was shot down. Several NVA companies blasted away at them with mortars, RPGs, and machine guns. Then a lone AK round struck Wright in the head, killing him instantly. Musso and O'Connor were shot several times, while half their Nongs lay dead around them, with the rest wounded. Unable to move, they were about to be overrun. Gathered with others at the launch site tent at Quan Loi, Roy Benavides listened to radio messages from the FAC and helicopter pilots and grew more upset by the minute. Leroy Wright was shot. Frenchy Musso was shot. Brian O'Connor was shot. All their Nongs were wounded or dead. A brigade of the U.S. 1st Infantry Division was within shouting distance, but they couldn't go into Cambodia after the SOG men. Not even a bright light team was available. Somebody had to do something. Weakened by loss of blood, Brian O'Connor heard a Huey coming in, but could barely move. In the helicopter doorway, a hefty figure made repeated signs of the cross, tossed out a medic bag, then rolled to the ground. It was Roy Benavides, a one-man bright light team who'd volunteered so spontaneously, he didn't even bring an M16, just a Bowie knife on his belt. Benavidez snatched up the medic bag and dashed 75 yards through withering enemy fire. Crack! An AK slug hit his right leg. He stumbled and skipped, but convinced himself he'd only snagged a thorn bush and kept running, then dove into the brush pile where Wright's men lay. With one look, Benavidez could see that Wright was dead, while Frenchy Mousseau had a serious head wound. O'Connor was coherent but barely able to crawl. Benavidez bound their wounds, injected morphine, and, ignoring NVA bullets and grenades, passed around ammunition he'd taken off several bodies and armed himself with an AK. Then Benavidez directed airstrikes and was calling in a Huey when an AK slug hit his right thigh, his second wound. When the Huey landed, Benavidez gave his AK to O'Connor and struggled to bring along Wright's body. Something threw him to the ground. He'd been shot through one lung, his third gunshot wound. Benavidez almost passed out, but somehow pulled himself back to his feet to see the Huey lying on its side, destroyed, a pilot and one door gunner dead. Coughing blood, Benavidez stumbled into the LZ to help survivors get free before the Huey's gas tanks exploded. While mortar shells burst everywhere, he called in phantoms, danger close. Benavidez was shot yet again. He tried to ignore it. 5 minutes later, he took still another slug. And another gunship was downed. Then, amid heavy gunship supporting fire and another airstrike, a lone Huey came in for one final extraction attempt. On board was Staff Sergeant Ronald Sammons, a Green Beret medic who helped Benavidez carry and drag injured crewmen from the crashed Huey and recon men to the helicopter. Benavidez hefted Frenchy Mousseau over his shoulder and staggered toward the chopper, walking past a fallen NVA. The enemy soldier rose up and clubbed him in the head with an AK, knocking Benavidez to his knees. Then the berserk NVA butt-stroked him in the face and turned to thrust at him with a bayonet. Instinctively, Benavidez pulled his Bowie knife, but not before the bayonet poked completely through his left forearm. Benavidez threw his body against the North Vietnamese and drove his knife into his side with such force that he couldn't pull it out. He left the NVA there, dead, the knife hilt pointing skyward, and stumbled to the Huey, pushed Mousseau aboard, and snatched up a fallen AK. Then two more NVA materialized and he shot them both. Powerful hands dragged Benavidez aboard, and the Huey lifted off. Bleeding almost into unconsciousness, Benavidez lay against the badly wounded Mousseau and clasped his hand. Just before they landed at the medevac hospital in Saigon, "I felt his fingers dig into my palm," Benavidez recalled, his arm twitching and jumping as if electric current was pouring through his body into mine. Then Frenchy Mousseau died. Wright and Mousseau received the Distinguished Service Cross posthumously. Benavidez spent almost a year in hospitals to recover from 7 major gunshot wounds, 28 shrapnel holes, and a bayonet wound. Credited with saving 8 lives, his incredible bravery was written up, but the paperwork was lost. Congress passed special legislation 13 years later, and retired Master Sergeant Roy Benavidez was flown to Washington, where President Ronald Reagan draped the Medal of Honor around his neck. Only one day after Benavidez's May 1968 rescue, RT Alabama inserted in Laos, 15 miles beyond the Aisha Valley, to emplace a wiretap. Led by Staff Sergeant John Allen, with Specialist 5 Kenneth Cryan, 1-1, Private First Class Paul King, 1-2, and 6 Nungs, RT Alabama was penetrating an area thought to conceal an entire NVA division that had been pushed into Laos when the first air cav had swept the adjacent Aisha. As they neared the LZ, Allen's men saw bunkers, trails, and hooches flash past beneath the trees. There was no sign of NVA at their insert LZ, so Allen radioed the customary Team OK and started his mission. They'd traveled an hour when Allen's sixth sense, the product of 20 missions into Laos and one North Vietnam bright light, reared up. Alan whispered to his 1-1, Ken Cryan, "This don't look right, don't smell right, just don't feel right." Taking a Nung with him, Alan slipped forward to investigate. They had crept about 250 yards when the foliage opened into a man-made clearing with upper tree branches tied together as natural camouflage. In the middle stood an elaborate bamboo and palm leaf house, clearly a major NVA headquarters, with soldiers coming and going. Beyond it, dug into a hillside, was a tunnel so wide two men could enter abreast. Alan snapped a half dozen photos, then crept back to RT Alabama. The 1-1, Ken Cryan, reported several NVA had passed nearby, thinking them trackers. Alan decided to shake them off. Then they heard shouts from their left and brush breaking on their back trail. Minutes later, the point man led them across a fresh, high-speed trail, probably a route into the headquarters they'd just discovered. With enemy voices only 50 yards behind them, Alan increased the pace to a light trot. They crossed another trail, and to their right heard shouts and crashing brush, answered by more shouts to their rear. Alan went to a full run and pivoted the team up a steep hill. Then the enemy opened fire, wildly spraying the area with AKs and machine guns, and as one, RT Alabama emptied their Car 15s in a quick burst. Cryan collapsed, holding his right thigh. He grunted he'd be all right, but couldn't stand. And Alan grabbed him, ignoring his plea to be left behind. One Nung took an AK hit center chest and slumped to the ground dead. His fellow Nungs carried him along. With Paul King behind him calling fruitlessly on the radio, Alan forged through the brush, scanning for anything that looked defensible. He spotted a bomb crater 50 yards uphill. "Cover me!" Alan shouted, tossed a grenade downhill to buy a few seconds, scooped up Cryan, then charged straight away to the crater, rolling into it with the rest of the team behind him. The bomb had impacted perpendicularly to the hill, making the crater almost a ledge, the upper lip blocking fire from uphill, the lower lip forming a small parapet. The surrounding terrain favored defense, with the foliage blasted clear for 10 yards on one side, while on the other a washout formed a natural obstacle that, combined with the landslide below, gave them all-around fields of fire. It wasn't perfect, but given their situation, it was a godsend. Alan spread an orange panel at the crater bottom. King turned his attention to the casualties. The Nung tribesman, he saw, was dead. Then, tearing open Cryan's bloodied pants, King saw an AK round had smashed his femur. He feared the shattered leg would have to come off. For now, King injected morphine, not using too much so that Cryan would remain conscious. Meanwhile, Alan and the Nungs hurriedly stripped grenades from their web gear and stacked them in the soft earth. Then Alan collected 2 dozen 40-millimeter grenade rounds the Nungs carried for his pistol-sized, sawed-off M79 grenade launcher. They'd been in the crater 2 minutes when a line of NVA broke from the woodline below, charging uphill. 3 grenades and several entire Car 15 magazines sprayed over the lip, forced them back. Then higher up the ridge, an RPG round crashed harmlessly. Alan's sawed-off grenade launcher dispatched the Rocketeers as 3 NVA scrambled across the ravine, too late to benefit from the supporting RPG. Alan dropped them with as many shots from his Car 15. Then all was quiet. A stalemate began. Periodically, the team heard NVA soldiers, and the Nungs responded as Alan had taught them by carefully lifting the spoon from a hand grenade, waiting 2 seconds, then lobbing it in a high arc so it would airburst above the enemy. This went on for more than an hour, with NVA probing toward them and Alan directing his defense with quick peeks from the top of the crater. At last, King looked up from the radio and shouted, "I've got Covey!" Alan slid down and grabbed the radio handset. "Handle things topside," he told King, and had started to talk when the young medic peeked over the edge of the crater. Alan opened his mouth to shout, but at that instant a bullet struck King, flipping him backward, his skull blown away. Alan tenderly laid Paul King at the bottom of the crater. RT Alabama, now had two dead men. Covey announced TAC Air was en route. It would be close, Allen thought, but TAC Air would clear the way for a rescue helicopter. Then the sky teemed with fighters. A pair of F-4 Phantoms dropped 500-pound bombs. Then more Phantoms arrived, followed by F-100 Super Sabres and A-1 Sky Raiders. Pass after pass riddled enemy positions with cannon fire, cluster bombs, and napalm. Then Hueys arrived, but the lead helicopter pilot radioed, "Is it secure down there?" Allen laughed. "Secure? Hell no, it ain't secure. And the longer you wait, the worse it's gonna get. But I think their heads are down." "Then we can't go in," the Huey pilot announced, and Covey argued with him, but it was no use. "Listen," Allen offered, "you bring in some napalm damned near right on top of us, then right away come in with the Huey, okay?" Grudgingly, the pilot agreed. A pair of A-1s rolled in with napalm, which flashed hot and dirty orange so close Allen could feel the air sucked from his lungs. He peeked over the edge. The only NVA he saw were running away or dead in the open ground. "Are you sure it's secure?" the pilot demanded. "Fuck no, it ain't secure. But that's as good as it's gonna get. We just pounded the hell out of him, and they're running away." The Huey dropped low, off in the distance. "But I still see people over here and over there," the pilot complained. "Jesus Christ," Allen pleaded, sensing the chances of escape evaporating with each second's hesitance. "They're running away! Running away! Come and get us, damn it!" Covey yelled too, and at last the pilot agreed to come in. As the Huey cleared the trees 100 yards away, it took a few rounds of ground fire, and, ignoring the marker panel, Allen waved, accelerated, and climbed away. By now the helicopters were low on fuel, and it was almost dark. Covey put in more airstrikes until there wasn't enough light to direct them. "I'll be back after first light, John," he promised, and almost added, "if you last that long." Allen shut off the radio to conserve batteries. He considered abandoning the bodies and slipping away during the night, but he couldn't carry Cryan and moved quietly. And the enemy knew that if they couldn't overwhelm RT Alabama that night, there'd be another rescue attempt at dawn. If they survived the night. It was entirely dark now, and Allen worked hurriedly. First he low-crawled to emplace 4 claymores, which he could detonate from the crater, along likely approaches. Then he checked Cryan's leg, loosened the tourniquet, and injected more morphine. That done, he warned his nungs not to fire in the darkness, because muzzle flashes would attract enemy fire. Instead they would throw grenades, silently, and with no warning. A half hour later they heard footsteps below the crater and dispatched the unseen enemy with hand grenades. Then crunching pebbles signaled NVA approaching on the right. Allen blew a claymore. Then it started again, but with machine gun fire raking the crater's lip, followed by an RPG rocket crashing into the ground nearby. Then nothing. Many times that night they responded to crunching leaves or a low whisper with grenades and claymore mines. Using his M79 as a mini-mortar, Allen lobbed 40mm rounds toward likely NVA positions. Miraculously, they kept the enemy enough off balance to prevent a concerted attack from reaching their crater. It was nearly dawn when Allen checked Cryan's tourniquet again and told him not to worry. His 1-1 was weakening, and the pain grew so bad that Cryan requested additional morphine. Then it was false dawn, and Allen spoke to each surviving Nung, applauding the fine job he'd done. Only one had been slightly wounded. Then the enemy launched an all-out assault with intersecting machine gun fire and whole salvos of RPG rounds, while NVA infantry fired and advanced toward the crater. A Chi-Com grenade plopped in, but a Nung tossed it back. Another bounced in, and Allen heaved it out. 2 more grenades fell in, and these too were thrown back before they could detonate. With the assaulting troops almost at the crater, it was the moment of truth. To stay low in the crater would have allowed the enemy to come right over the top, yet to expose themselves to the enemy's withering fire was suicide. Alan had no choice. "Now," he shouted, and he and the five Nungs rose up, cutting down a line of NVA seconds before they would have overrun them. Alan dropped down again into protective cover and fought off shock as he surveyed the result. Seconds earlier, he and five Nungs had jumped up. Not a half minute later, only he and one Nung were still alive. RT Alabama, which had inserted a day ago with nine men, was down to himself, the badly wounded Ken Cryan, and one Nung. All the others lay around him, dead. After the last man's death rattle stopped, Alan numbly dragged his teammates to the bottom of the crater. Thoughts welled up and nearly overwhelmed him. But Alan had to fight the urge to cry for his dead friends and comrades. But his work wasn't done, he told himself, and he regained control. Alan froze. Beside him was a Chinese hand grenade. How long it had been there, he didn't know. Delicately, he tossed it away. Then Covey was overhead and the sky was abuzz with aircraft. But as the first pair of fighters learned, RT Alabama was circled by anti-aircraft guns. Six 12.7mm machine guns ringed the crater at 500 yards, and beyond was another ring, this of heavy 37mm flak guns that had been trucked in during the night. When a Phantom swooped low, 37mm guns opened up, tracking him until he erupted in a fireball. Other fighters concentrated on the anti-aircraft guns, then Covey brought in more airstrikes around the crater, then the guns opened up again. At last, fire slackened, but by now both Covey and the choppers were too low on fuel to attempt a pickup. While they returned to Vietnam to refuel and rearm, a Sky Raider pilot brought in more air around the besieged team. At one point, the gallant A-1 pilot, his own ordnance totally expended, opened the canopy of his propeller-driven plane and swooped just above Alan, tipping his wing 45 degrees and emptying his revolver at the NVA. In spite of the tense situation, Alan could not help but admire that crazy bastard and swore he'd buy him a drink one day. When Covey returned, he resumed the aerial pounding until, at last, an extract could be attempted, using USAF Jolly Green helicopters. The lead Jolly Green pilot told Alan he couldn't land on the steep hill, and insisted would lower a three-seated jungle penetrator, but due to altitude he could lift just two men. "But the goddamn penetrator is built for three men," Alan shouted into his handset. "We got three men down here." The pilot was insistent. Alan looked at Cryan, too groggy to speak anymore, and at the diffident Nung, who would do whatever he ordered. "Send the goddamn thing in," he radioed. A pair of A-1s roared overhead, miniguns and cannon groaning as the penetrator landed. Alan lashed in Cryan while the Nung slid into the adjacent folding seat. He leaned his face close to Cryan's and shouted, "See ya at Foo Bai!" The Jolly Green lifted upward. One bullet smacked the Nung, and another. A round struck Cryan, and another. Blood trickled down on Alan's upturned face, then it fell freely, and still the enemy fired, not a round at the Jolly Green, all of it at his teammates. "No!" Alan screamed as he watched the helicopter slip away, a line of deadly tracers following his men, their shirts flying open and arms flailing the air. "You bastards! Bastards!" Alan screamed. "Dirty fucking bastards!" Then it was quiet again. Alan couldn't understand. Had the enemy fired at the helicopter, they might have knocked it down, but they held back, giving false hope, then sadistically shot his men. "I'm making a run for it," Alan announced to Covey. Covey pleaded with him to wait for more air. He'd talked to the Jolly Green, and Alan's teammates had only been wounded. "It's no use," Alan insisted. "I'm making a break for it." "But where will you go, John?" The vision of his men hanging helplessly while bullets tore into them was fresh and horrible. "I don't know, but I can't stay here. I can't cover everything by myself. Get all the air you've got left and dump it all around me, right on top of me. All of it, at once. All of it. Covey protested, but there was no time left. Alan slid deep into the crater, wedging himself between the bodies and held his hands over his ears while the ground shook and dust and clods of earth fell around him. Then the bombing stopped. Alan checked his car 15. It was empty. Dumping his useless web gear, he found 2 20-round magazines in a Nung's gear, slipped one into his weapon, the other into his pocket. For the first time, he noticed a thin washout at the bottom of the crater, just wide enough for him to squeeze into the open. A pair of F-4 Phantoms screamed past with afterburners to divert attention. Grabbing the radio, Alan shinnied into the open and raced madly downhill, directly into an NVA who suddenly stood up. Alan shoved his car 15 into the man's belly and pulled the trigger. Seconds later, he was in a woodline, and another NVA swung an AK toward him but never finished, and still Alan ran. Mistaking him for a fellow NVA, another soldier watched the SOG recon man run toward him, and Alan dropped him, too. Replaced his spent magazine and kept going, never even looking sideways. Alan jumped into a chest-high washout and followed it 100 yards downhill. To his right, a 12.7mm machine gun opened up at a passing fighter, its five-man crew so intently watching the aircraft that they didn't see Alan level his Car 15. In 2 seconds they were dead, and he was running again. From the excited shouts behind him, he knew the NVA realized an American had escaped and were after him. Adrenaline drained and gasping, he came providentially upon a small, cave-like washout, just large enough to crawl into. He checked his last magazine. 3 rounds left, with a fourth in the chamber. There was no hope, no possibility of escape, so there was no need for fear or remorse, and once he accepted this, a tremendous calm settled over him. The only remaining matter was the number of enemy soldiers he could take with him, which, if he restricted himself to semi-auto fire, meant 3, with the 4th round for himself. He was in control again. Alan slid the radio out to raise Covey. "How are my boys doing?" Alan asked. "Medics say they're going to be just fine, John, just fine. But we've got to get you out of there, too." Squeezing himself into that tight hole, Alan had fighters blanket the whole hillside with 20mm fire, machine guns, rockets, and cluster bombs. Though Alan warned against it, a king bee roared above the treetops and dropped a rope near him. A 12.7mm machine gun opened fire, pummeling the king bee until it tipped into the jungle and exploded. Alan knew there were no survivors. After calling in air on the gun, Alan ran farther down the ravine, directing still more air to his front. Then Covey said an American Huey was inbound with a Maguire rig. Ground fire erupted, and Alan prayed the Huey would pass by, but the pilot pressed on. The Huey suddenly went out of control and sailed past, enemy tracers following it as it dove and crashed into the valley below. Alan was sure that more men were dead. He had to regather his wits. He'd been heading east toward the border. Maybe that's what the enemy expected. He called in another airstrike, this time to the north. When the last bomb exploded, he was up and running north. Then he called air south and kept running north. He repeated the tactic several times over the next 2 hours until he came upon a large open field. At last, a king bee spiraled in, and Alan ran for it, ran for his life. There was no enemy fire. Within an hour, they were landing at Phu Bai. It was as if Alan were coming out of a trance. All he could think about was visiting Cryan and the surviving Nung at the evacuation hospital. Alan's recon comrades rushed to his king bee to thrust a beer into his hand. But strangely, not a word was offered. Their glances conveyed a truth none could express, that Covey had not admitted, though John Alan had known the truth all along. Later Covey would explain he had to lie because had Alan known Ken Cryan and the Nung had died, each man riddled by more than 30 slugs, he might have thrown his life away. Alan understood. though this overwhelming truth sapped his last strength. Except for John Allen, RT Alabama no longer existed. Though many thought John Allen deserved the Medal of Honor, a jealous NCO reportedly confessed years later to manipulating the paperwork, so the award was downgraded to a Silver Star. The losses did not stop with RT Alabama. The Covey rider who supported RT Alabama, Sergeant First Class John Robertson, was killed. 15 days later, and only 10 miles from where RT Alabama was lost, when a rocket hit the King Bee he was riding. Then 3 days after that, RT Idaho inserted not 5 miles from there. That afternoon, 10 Glenn Lane and 11 Robert Owen had a brief conversation with Covey, explaining they couldn't talk because NDA were all around them. It was the last anyone ever heard from RT Idaho. RT Oregon went in to search for Idaho and found a place where concussion grenades had exploded. Lane and Owen probably were incapacitated and captured by NVA counter-recon specialists. A large NVA force hit RT Oregon, and with every member of the team wounded, they narrowly escaped. RT Idaho's loss was the last event in Colonel Singlob's 2-year tour as Chief SOG. His final contribution, he believed, was ensuring he had a suitable replacement. One night, Singlob phoned an old UCLA classmate in Germany with the 8th Division to announce proudly, "Steve, I've nominated you to take my place." On the other end, Colonel Steve Cavanaugh asked, "Where?" "Why, SOG." Cavanaugh paused, then asked, "What's SOG?" Singlob's choice was a wise one. As a young paratroop officer in World War II, Steve Cavanaugh had made 2 combat jumps with the 11th Airborne Division, fighting the Japanese in New Guinea and the Philippines. His second jump was on a North Luzon drop zone secured by Don Headhunter Blackburn's guerrillas. Cavanaugh had served a 1961 Vietnam tour as the country's senior U.S. Army training officer, then had run the Special Warfare Development Branch at Fort Bragg's JFK Center. He went on to command the German-based 10th Special Forces Group. Then, being groomed for higher command, he was appointed 8th Division Chief of Staff. And now the boy who dreamed of being a professional soldier would head his country's largest and most secret special operations organization since the OSS. Cavanaugh arrived at SOG's new Saigon headquarters, a converted hotel on Rue Pasteur. The old MACV headquarters Westmoreland vacated when he moved to a new Thai Son Nhut complex. While offering useful advice, Singlob issued a warning about that damned patch. A few SOG men had scribbled a design on a cocktail napkin and had it run off at a local tailor shop. It featured a green beret skull in a yellow shellburst with Air Force wings and a Navy and Marine anchor. "It compromised the whole operation," complained Singlob. "Look at the thing. It's no studies and observations patch." Cavanaugh found the patches a lost cause, though he insisted that men visiting Saigon wear sterile uniforms. Despite his lofty position, Cavanaugh was always supportive, almost a fatherly figure, and a real listener, respected by the recon men whose advice he often sought. That summer of 1968, under Chief SOG Cavanaugh, SOG refocused its operations across the border and tapered off in-country missions except in the Eshaw Valley, which remained a SOG haunt. Situated beyond a barrier of imposing mountains that masked it from coastal enclaves 40 miles away at Phu Bai and Da Nang, the Eshaw Valley stretched 25 miles northwest to southeast on the Laotian frontier. 2 miles wide in places, the Eshaw's flat bottom was grassy and so open it was eerie. Flying overhead, you could feel eyes following you. 2 abandoned airfields and 3 ghost camps haunted the valley floor, while its major road, Highway 548, connected with Laotian Highway 922. From adjacent Laotian base areas, the NVA built a network of 40 high-speed trails into the valley. Northern Eshaw's Tomboy Mountains contained immense chambers hewn from solid rock and fitted with heavy iron doors, so well constructed that they withstood B-52 strikes. On 3 August, the reconstituted RT Idaho, led by 10 Wilbur Boggs, inserted into the Eshaw Valley about 10 miles from where the old RT Idaho had vanished on 20 May. Boggs' 1-1 specialist, 4 John Walton, was an accomplished poker player, friendly, intelligent, and a talented medic, capable of surgery. Idaho's 1-2 was a new man, Private First Class Tom Cunningham. Not long after insertion, swarms of NVA descended on RT Idaho, and soon 10 Boggs was seriously wounded. 2 yards were dead, and the team immobile, hopelessly encircled by NVA so close Walton could see smoke drifting from their cigarettes. With his team about to be overrun, young Walton did the only thing he could and called an airstrike practically on top of RT Idaho, which hit friend and foe alike. The NVA fell back. It took every bit of Walton's medical skill to keep his wounded teammates alive, though Tom Cunningham would lose a leg. That anyone made it out is attributable to Walton's courage, cool head, and medical ability. He was awarded the Silver Star. Back home in Arkansas, the young Green Beret's enterprising father was transforming his drugstore chain into the world's largest family-owned retail system, Walmart. You'd have to tie wild horses to billionaire Sam Walton's son John, a humble sort, to get him to talk today about his valiant wartime service and the lives he saved that desperate day in the Eshaw Valley. It was that same month of August 1968 that brought the war to SOG's CCN headquarters, where a misperception had reigned that danger lurked in faraway areas, but not among Da Nang's sprawling bases. At 3 a.m. on 23 August, more than 100 NVA sappers penetrated the CCN compound, tossing satchel charges and blasting away with AKs. For the next 3 hours, Green Berets and SEALs from the nearby SOG Naval Advisory Detachment compound combated the NVA raiders. By dawn it was over, and the terrible toll was visible. 15 Special Forces officers and NCOs died that night, the greatest single-day loss of Green Berets in Vietnam. 16 Nungs, Yards, and South Vietnamese were dead. Some 38 enemy were killed and 9 captured, all wounded. Among the dead NVA was a cook's helper from the mess hall, apparently their inside agent. When Chief SOG Colonel Kavanaugh flew in that morning to assess the damage, he came upon a detail carrying away Master Sergeant Gilbert Secor's body. Not a year earlier, Secor had walked into his office in Bad Tölz, Germany, to volunteer for another tour in Vietnam. Watching them carry Secor away, killed in his sleep by a satchel charge, Kavanaugh thought, what a senseless way to die. To this day, there's an unresolved debate about that sapper attack, whether it was targeted to disrupt SOG cross-border activities, or whether the NVA saw CCN as just another U.S. compound worth raiding. Because the raid hit just as the bombing halt enabled the NVA to shift troops and equipment from North Vietnam into Laos to expand the trail, many are convinced that the Da Nang attack was a deliberate strategic attempt to cripple SOG at a critical time. Despite the Da Nang sapper attack, teams continued penetrating Laos, and that fall of 1968, there was no recon man luckier than Sergeant Lin Black, Jr., a recon 1-1. On 5 October, his team landed in central Laos, and almost right away they were hit by numerous NVA, with their 10 Staff Sergeant James Stride killed in the first burst. In danger of being overrun and unable to drag Stride's body, the team split, with the enemy in pursuit. All day, Black and 2 Yards played hide-and-seek with the enemy, twice fighting their way through their pursuers. They literally ran right through the NVA, said recon man John Meyer. It happened so fast, the NVA didn't realize what was happening. Finally, a USAF Jolly Green helicopter from Thailand hovered overhead and lowered a 3-seated jungle penetrator. Black helped the 2 Yards climb in, then their missing 1-2 arrived, so he put him in the 3rd seat. Black would wait on the ground while they were winched aboard. Masked by the noisy aircraft, two NVA crept up and lunged at the young Green Beret. AKs almost pressed to his belly. With that sweet sound of freedom swirling only 100 feet overhead and its umbilical cord on its way back down, Black grabbed one AK barrel and held it down, while his other hand seized the second soldier's AK, jerked it away, and crashed the butt over the NVA's astonished head. As quickly, Black twisted the first AK free, smashed it wickedly into the NVA's face, leaped on the hoist and rode upward, while USAF door gunners ripped the countryside with miniguns. As the Jolly Green Giant lifted away, Black felt the heavy bird bounce from an RPG rocket impacting its armored belly, but the pilot squeezed over the next ridge and made a controlled crash in an open field. Another Jolly Green retrieved them all, and at last they were away, alive and free. Stride's body was never recovered. Bill Copley was not as lucky as Lynn Black. A few weeks after Black's escape, a recon team in southern Laos was hit by a party of NVA led by trackers. In the exchange of fire, Copley was badly wounded and cried out, "Help me! I'm hit!" A teammate carried Copley on his back as far as he could, then he fell. He tried to administer first aid, but to no avail. Copley's face showed signs of approaching death. Rapidly closing NVA forced the teammate away. A bright light team later found only blood where Copley had lain. By the end of the year, singing Hey Blue had become nearly a weekly event, and almost every building at CNN in Da Nang had been named for dead and missing men, such as Bill Copley. In 1968, excluding the August Sapper attack and Khe Sanh casualties from incoming fire, CCN lost 18 Americans KIA. And 18 MIA, the equivalent of 15 recon teams. CCN had fewer than 15 active recon teams. Combined with the 119 SOG Americans wounded in Laos that year, that meant that every single SOG recon man was wounded at least once in 1968, and about half died. The terrible truth became clear. SOG recon casualties exceeded 100%, the highest sustained American loss rate since the Civil War. 11. A Pale Blue Ribbon. Each SOG forward operating base, FOB, Da Nang, Phubai, Kon Tum, and Ban Mae Thot, was assigned about a dozen U.S.-led recon teams. Only about 6 teams were combat-ready at any given time because casualties had depleted the other 6 teams. Therefore, half the teams constantly were recovering and retraining, while the other half performed hazardous missions until casualties made them combat-incapable. By early 1968, Kon Tum-based RT Main was approaching the end of that 6-month active mission cycle, and 210 Fred Zabotowski, readying for his final recon mission, it seemed he'd cheated the Grim Reaper. This wasn't because Zab hadn't given the NVA plenty of opportunities to end his 26 years of life. As older, more experienced teams fell by the wayside, Zab had shown tactical skill that made him worthy of tougher missions. RT Main's assignments had grown incrementally more hazardous. His assistant team leader, Staff Sergeant Doug Glover, didn't just sense the growing danger. His body bore testament to it. He had been seriously wounded on each of their last 2 missions. While Glover mended, Zabotowski had led 2 perilous bright lights, recovering a 10's body after the NVA captured, tortured, and burned him to death in Laos, then searching for Charlie White, who'd fallen off a Maguire rig in Cambodia. Now, ominously, Zab's final target was the Bra, the river curve where Highway 110 split eastward from the Ho Chi Minh Trail's major north-south route, Highway 96. Across the Bra flowed all NVA troops, supplies, and weapons for South Vietnam's Central Highlands and Cambodia's northern half. Hidden in the Bra was the NVA's Binh Tram 37, A major base with stockpiles defended by masses of anti-aircraft guns, security battalions, and counter-recon units. Encompassing targets Juliet, Hotel, India, and November 9, Debra was the hottest area in southern Laos. When that target list came out every month, recalled 10 Lowell Stevens, you were secretive. You were silent. You didn't want to make it too well known, but you hoped and prayed that you didn't get it. Another team leader, Lloyd O'Daniels, warned, you'd better have a full magazine with you when you went in, buddy, because you were going to need it very damned shortly. 2 weeks into the 1968 Tet Offensive, with Hue still occupied and Khe San under siege, RT Main was slated to go into Juliet 9 to learn whether the NVA were pulling back, reinforcing or resupplying their offensive in the Central Highlands. Because Zabotosky's freshly healed assistant, Doug Glover, would replace him after the mission, they reversed roles. Glover would be acting 10 and Zab the 1-1, while Maine's newest man, Staff Sergeant Purcell Bragg, was 1-2. The night before insert, the normally happy-go-lucky Glover went to Zab and announced he would die the next day. Zabotosky tried to make light of it, but the premonition deeply concerned him. A 10 needed confidence, especially in the bra. No recon man went into the bra without some sense of dread, yet things didn't seem that bad the next morning when RT Main's two Hueys came in low level and landed with not one round of ground fire. Acting as 10, Glover led them off the LZ and instinctively went for the thickest cover. He didn't realize it, but he was taking them into a box canyon whose steep walls wouldn't be apparent for a half hour. They'd hardly entered the 300-yard-wide canyon when they made out a line of bunkers arrayed before them. When Zabotosky looked closer to assess the bunker's age, an NVA platoon rushed in to man them. Then gunfire ripped the air, and RT Main executed an IA, immediate action drill, against enemy soldiers, only 25 yards away, then fell back. Take over the team, Glover shouted to Zabotosky. He did, just as 1-2 Bragg reported Covey had radioed that two other teams were in contact and RT Main was on its own for at least 45 minutes. Zab told Glover to lead the team back to the LZ and set up a perimeter while he bought time. No one had been wounded. Zabotosky watched them trot away, then hastily emplaced the claymore. SOG intelligence later determined the box canyon he was attempting to block by himself contained a regimental command post, possibly the headquarters of Bin Tram 37 itself. Momentarily, an NVA platoon arrived. Zab scattered them by blowing the claymore and tossing several grenades, then fired his Car 15 on semi-auto to conserve ammo. The NVA kept trying to assault him, but he held them at bay by chucking a grenade and repositioning when it detonated. Moving laterally to the advancing enemy, Zab created the illusion that several men were facing them, so they couldn't quite outflank him. Outfoxing the enemy, Zab fired 15 magazines and kept them bottled up for 30 minutes until he heard A1s overhead. Using his emergency radio, he called in the A1s, which dumped their ordnance, including one 750-pound bomb that fell so close the concussion lifted him off the ground and knocked the wind out of him. Then in one fast dash, Zab ran all the way to the LZ, where he found Doug Glover calling in more A1s while still more fighters arrived. One bomb touched off 64 secondary explosions back in the Box Canyon, and RT Main hadn't taken a single casualty. But while Zab was in the canyon, other NVA had hauled in 12.7mm heavy machine guns, whose tracers now arced high above the LZ. Then Covey radioed a warning. He'd spotted four companies converging on the LZ, and one company was almost there. Zabotosky hastily arrayed his men just as that company launched a wild assault with 100 screaming NVA. Like a World War II Japanese banzai charge, the enemy stampeded right across the open space through mass Car 15 fire and almost made it. No sooner did Zab's men stop one charge than another company arrived, and it too assaulted, running a gauntlet of napalm and cannon fire. Only desperately close-range rifle and pistol fire halted them, Bodies were visibly stacking up. Artemain could not keep this up much longer. All that stopped the next charge was a napalm strike right across the enemy's long axis. Then Covey radioed, "Zab, you got all your guys there?" He looked around. "Affirmative." "Why?" Covey rolled in with a marking rocket. "Then we've got another unit double-timing in from your west, about 400 meters away." It was too dangerous to send helicopters into an LZ covered by heavy machine guns and drawing more enemy by the minute. While A-1s and gunships hit the LZ, and with Hueys just minutes away, Covey had RT Main run 150 yards southeast along a stream bed and through a woodline to a safer landing zone. They reached the open field without contact, and no NVA had followed them. Exploiting the lull, Covey sent in the first of two Hueys to extract RT Main. Everyone held his breath. Purcell Bragg and two yards dashed aboard the aircraft, and it lifted up, climbed over the trees and out, slick and safe. That left Zab, Glover, and 4 yards for the second bird. But before it arrived, 100 NVA rose up from 3 sides of the new LZ and rushed them. While Glover directed A-1s, Zab and the 4 yards fought fiercely and barely stopped the first wave. Then came a second. And a third. By the fourth, they were down to 2 magazines apiece, and Glover was shooting like mad, too. 1 NVA got within arm's length before Zab dropped him. The NVA paused to reform, and it was now or never. Under the heavy fire of gunships and A-1s, the second Huey came in between the team and the enemy, just as the NVA rose up again. It was a race for the Huey. The door gunners and SOG men mowed down a long line of NVA. Sabatowski ran around the bird to shoot several that almost made it to the aircraft, and jumped aboard, shooting 1 last NVA who was so close the man's blood splattered him. Everyone fired wildly as the Huey dipped its nose and the main rotor pulled them up and away. The thought flashed in Zab's mind that Glover's premonition was wrong. He'd give him hell tonight in the club. They were 75 feet up and almost clear of the LZ when an RPG blast rocked the Huey, spinning the tail boom into the main rotor with a horrible shriek. With 1 glance, Covey understood the catastrophe. The Huey split in 2, burned furiously. Not 1 emergency radio beacon came up. No passengers or crew climbed from the inferno. SOG policy required that downed aircraft be bombed to prevent the enemy from recovering codes, maps, or radios. No one moved down there but NVA. The FAC began briefing a pair of F-4 Phantoms. Aboard 1 helicopter high overhead, Special Forces medic Luke Nance Jr. watched the blazing Huey and thought about his friend Fred Zabotowski and what a shame it was that he'd died. "It's hot. The sun's so hot. Hot." Fred Zabotowski forced himself to consciousness to find his clothes afire and the burning Huey 20 feet away. Zab could barely breathe. In addition to severe burns and shrapnel wounds, he'd suffered several crushed vertebrae and broken ribs. He rolled clumsily on the ground to extinguish his clothes, then found his Car 15, but the barrel had bent almost double. The Huey had snapped in 2 just behind the pilot section. They were still strapped in their seats, trapped in the flames. Lying on its side, the troop compartment was a white-hot blast furnace from which Zab heard the final cries of Doug Glover, 4 yards, and the 2 door gunners, Sergeants Melvin Dye and Robert Griffith. He couldn't have helped those poor bastards. It was an effort just to get to his knees. His crushed back and burns hurt so much he could hardly think. He forced himself to crawl toward the jungle, at least to deny the NVA his body after he died. He looked back 1 final time and realized the flames hadn't yet engulfed the pilots. He would never understand how he found the strength, but Zabotowski stumbled to his feet, staggered forward and tore at the scorched door handle until it gave, then grabbed the semi-conscious co-pilot, fell over with him, and pulled him to safety. Everything was burned off the man except his leather gun belt. The pilot still was inside and the fire seemed too bad to go through, but Zab climbed right into the flames. He could feel his flesh burning as he undid the pilot's harness. Then the fuel cells exploded and an orange fireball swept over them, blowing both Fred and the pilot clear. 3,000 feet overhead, Luke Nance looked down, looked again, then shouted to his aircraft commander, "Dang it, I saw somebody moving down there. Go down there now, I'll get him." For all the chopper pilot knew, it was just NVA searching the wreckage. "We'd better get out of here," he announced. "No," Nance insisted. "We ain't gonna get out of here. We're going down there to get that fella." Nance's Huey pilot took another look and confirmed there were people by the aircraft. It was worth a try. Despite 12.7mm tracers arcing above the LZ and AKs chattering from the woodlines, the Huey pilot took his bird in, door gunners straining against their tethers and spraying everywhere with M60s. As the Huey came over the last trees, Luke Nance fired his Car 15. Then he spotted Fred Zabotosky, saw him stand and fall, dragging one pilot then the other toward the sound of the Huey's whopping rotor. Ignoring the enemy, Nance leaped out and ran to Zab's side. Zab's face was so black and burned that Nance hardly recognized him. Together they carried and dragged the two aviators into the Huey, then it lifted away. Escorting gunships and A-1s practically touched the trees, they pressed so low to fire cannons and machine guns to help get the rescue helicopter out. Then the Huey pilot poured on speed to get the badly wounded men to Vietnam. All the way to the field hospital at Pleiku, Nance worked to keep them alive. The following morning, after blanketing the LZ with tear gas, Sergeant First Class Clarence Pappy Webb took in a bright light platoon but found the burned-out Huey a molten mass. The bright light platoon and a FAC counted 109 enemy bodies on the first LZ and 68 on the second. RT Main's fight had been incredible. General Westmoreland visited the hospital to pin a Purple Heart to Zabotosky's pillow and tell him he was being submitted for the Medal of Honor. Westmoreland was almost apologetic when he told Zab his mission location and classification, made it unlikely, though, that Zab would ever wear that pale blue ribbon around his neck. Zabotosky and the two aviators were evacuated to Japan. One pilot thanked the Green Beret just before succumbing to the burns that covered 85% of his body. The other Huey pilot, Richard Griffith and Zab, survived. Thankfully, Westmoreland was wrong. 1 year later, Fred Zabotosky held his mended spine straight while President Richard Nixon fastened the Medal of Honor around his neck. The RT Main 1-0 could think only of his teammates. "I was presented and I wear the medal," he said later, "but it was earned by Doug Glover and my other Special Forces team members." It was 4 months after Fred Zabotosky's Medal of Honor mission that another Recon 1-0, again from Khantoum FOB 2, demonstrated equally incredible valor. This time it was a 23-year-old New Yorker, Specialist 5 John Keddenberg, operating near Highway 110, about a dozen miles east of the Bra. Keddenberg's team had been in a small firefight, then the enemy rushed in a battalion, 500 NVA, to scour the jungle for them. No stranger to tough situations, Keddenberg had been present 6 months earlier when his first recon team leader, Sergeant First Class Dan Wagner, was killed. He managed to get Wagner's body out and inherited RT Nevada, becoming the new 1-0. Recon man Rich Ryan, who'd served earlier with Keddenberg, thought him smart and intense, not the kind to get drunk and do goofy things in the club. He was devoted to his team. At one point, the NVA battalion pinned and encircled RT Nevada, but the SOG team shot its way through and began running cross-country, hundreds of NVA hot on their heels. Anytime RT Nevada paused, the enemy caught up and a fierce fight ensued. Finally, Keddenberg sent his men on and stayed behind, conducting a gallant rearguard fight against the pursuing enemy. Rejoining his men, Keddenberg learned 1 yard was missing, but he couldn't risk the whole team for a man who might be dead. He radioed for a string extraction, and through a combination of fighting and evading, finally got RT Nevada to a hole in the jungle canopy. They seemed to have shaken off their pursuers. While a Huey came in, dropped ropes and lifted away 4 men, Kettenberg called airstrikes against their back trail. A second bird dropped ropes and Kettenberg and the three remaining Nevada men climbed into the four McGuire rigs just as the NVA broke through supporting fire from gunships and A-1s. Then the teams missing Montagnard arrived, drawn by the sound of the Huey. All John Kettenberg had to do was give a thumbs up to the helicopter crew chief, and they would have lifted away, safe and alive. Instead, he unsnapped himself, gave his rig to the newly arrived yard, and stood guard while he climbed in. Then the young Green Beret waved off the Huey and turned alone to face a horde of onrushing NVA. Witnesses aboard the departing helicopter saw Kettenberg shoot six NVA at almost point-blank range before enemy fire struck home, and he collapsed, mortally wounded. The last airstrike went in right on top of the fallen 1-0. Kettenberg's self-sacrifice surprised no one who knew him. Rich Ryan called him the kind of guy you'd think would do what he did. His SOG's second posthumous Medal of Honor, a bright light team, recovered John Kettenberg's body. There was yet another man there at Khantoum in recon company, a contemporary and friend of both Zabotofsky and Kettenberg, who had become a legend throughout SOG and the secret world of special operations, Sergeant First Class Robert Howard. Built like a lumberjack, Howard was square-jawed, handsome and rock-tough, yet quiet and unassuming, with a soul and a conscience. Growing up in Opelika, Alabama, he'd been inspired by his father and four uncles who'd all been paratroopers in World War II. Of the five, two died in combat, while three others, including his father, suffered terrible wounds to which they eventually succumbed. Poor materially but rich in family, Bob Howard and his sister picked cotton to help support their mother and maternal grandparents. The Opelika High football star was offered a scholarship, but college could wait. He enlisted at age 17, eager to wear silver paratrooper wings like his father and uncles. By 1966, he was 101st Airborne Paratrooper recovering from wounds when some Green Beret wardmates befriended him. He left the hospital bound for the 5th Special Forces Group. When he arrived at Khantoum, FOB 2, in early 1967, casualties had depleted recon ranks, but the supply room was in equal crisis. Nobody knew how to requisition supplies except the new guy, Howard, who'd once been a supply sergeant. First Sergeant Billy Greenwood tried to keep him in supply, but that didn't last. You just couldn't keep him out of the war, Greenwood said. So Howard ran missions like anyone else, but instead of blowing off steam during stand down, he wrote requisitions to keep supplies flowing. Unique in U.S. military annals, Robert Howard was submitted for the Medal of Honor three times in 13 months, and many thought he should have received all three. He remains to this day the most highly decorated American soldier, his uniform displaying the Medal of Honor, Distinguished Service Cross, Silver Star, and numerous lesser awards, plus 8 Purple Hearts. This is the man who one night ran alongside an enemy truck on Highway 110, holding a Claymore detonator in his hand, then tossed the mine into a truck full of startled NVA and detonated it. On another occasion, he saw a VC terrorist riding the back of a motorbike toss a grenade at a GI chow line. Howard took off at a dead run, snatched an M16 away from an amazed security guard, dropped to one knee, carefully aimed and shot the driver dead, then chased the passenger a half mile and shot him dead too. What's all the more impressive is that Howard thought both incidents unremarkable and received no award for either. His first Medal of Honor submission came in November 1967, when 1-0 Johnny Gilreath's team found a huge rice and ammunition stockpile in southeast Laos. While Gilreath kept it under surveillance, SOG assembled a hatchet force company to land and destroy the cache. Howard volunteered to take in a recon team to guide the company from the LZ to Gilreath's team, then scout for approaching NVA. The element of surprise didn't last. Three helicopters were badly damaged by ground fire during insert, yet Howard was able to avoid NVA ambushes and bring the hatchet force safely to Gilreath's team. While the hatchet force destroyed the cache, Howard took out a security patrol and soon encountered four NVA, all of whom he dispatched with a single magazine. But then his team became pinned down by a camouflaged machine gun bunker. Howard crawled toward the gun, killed an NVA sniper who tried to stop him, then rushed the machine gun nest and killed all its occupants at point-blank range with his M16. No sooner did he climb from the bunker than a second machine gun position unleashed a barrage. He pulled back and called in air on it, then crawled forward to assess damage. The bombs had missed. Pinned down directly outside the strong point with a blazing machine gun barrel only 6 inches above his head, his award citation later said, he threw a hand grenade into the aperture of the emplacement, killing the gunners and temporarily silencing the weapon. When more NVA took over the gun, Howard seized a LAW rocket launcher and stood amid a hail of bullets, fired his weapon, and completely demolished the position. Howard's one-man attack so demoralized the NVA that they abandoned the hill, leaving the Hatchet Force free to destroy tons of ammunition and rice. After the operation, Chief Sog Singlaub had Howard and Gilreath flown to Saigon to brief a clearly impressed General Westmoreland. When they'd finished, Westmoreland asked if there was anything he could do for them. Gilreath said, "Sir, I'd like to go to flight school and to become an aviator." The 4-star U.S. commander gave Gilreath a commission on the spot, and he soon left for flight school. Howard said he only wanted back into action, and he got his wish, too, along with a Distinguished Service Cross, though he'd been recommended for the Medal of Honor. A career aviator.